that by that point, this whole conflict will be a lot less humorous because one of the Houthis, and I think the Houthis to some degree are relying on their lack of capacity and their assumption that things aren't necessarily going to get too bad. It's entirely possible that the Houthis will manage to hit a ship in a catastrophic way, and this will be a lot more serious.
Hello, and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. I am Rory, the pod person, and I am joined with Robert, the politics person.
That's fair. That's fair. Like that pod person. Is that, have you ever seen Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Rory?
I haven't, but I've heard of it. It does remind me of that.
I too have not heard it. It's impressive that some film from the 50s has enough cultural currency that we both
definitely
heard of pod person, but have no idea of what it means. Some strange vestige. I wonder if that's an artifact of our age, you know, or if that pod person still means things to people. How you doing, Rory?
I'm doing well. I'm just off now for Christmas holidays. How are you doing? Have you recovered from your COVID?
Yeah, I recovered from COVID, and then I think I got the flu for a couple days. So it's very rare for me to be sick twice in a month, and I think I pointed out on a live chat it's because I was lazy and stupid and didn't get my vaccines.
Well, I've always said you're lazy and stupid.
Fair. It's accurate. It's definitely accurate.
Like you've just left the chat. Are you still there?
No, I'm still here.
Okay. It seemed like you just rage quit on my end.
Oh yeah, like screw it. This is it. I'm done. I've had enough serial humiliations. After a decade of being unsuccessful on the internet, I'm just that was it. That was the straw that broke the camel back. One bit of snarky Northern Irish humor, and I'm out. I'm out.
Would you like to talk about something that isn't lazy but is definitely stupid?
Oh, I'd love to talk about stupid things, but I'd actually like to talk about something kind of cool first.
Okay,
if you wouldn't mind. I'm sort of in a good mood this morning. Because I'm helping somebody sue the U.S. government, which is...
oh, my goodness.
Very exciting.
It's not me, by the way.
No, not you. No, it's an organization that I've worked with, you know, procured services from, really, for a number of years now. And they are suing the U.S. government because the U.S. government is trying to use sanctions policy to bar them from doing their business. And I think it's really fascinating. The Intercept did a nice write-up on it. Columbia University, one of their sort of pro bono free speech outfits, is taking up the case. And yeah, sued the Department of the Treasury, the Department of Justice. And it's fun. There's like a 40-page complaint. And there's a page talking about, you know, why Rob Morris likes the Exchange Foundation and would not like this to happen. And it's... it was fun to be able to contribute to that, and it's fun to just fun to sue the government, right? It feels good.
So it's nice to get your legal hat back on?
I mean, barely tangentially. I just talked to a few lawyers and some folks at the Exchange Foundation and made sure we had the story straight. And if I, very unlikely, but perhaps if I'm called to do a further affidavit, it accurately represents what I was saying. But no, I think it's pretty important, and I think it's very worthwhile, and it's nice to, it's just fun to sue the government, right? What can I say? There's an Intercept article talking about the details of the case that we'll put in the show notes. No need to burden folks with that today, but you know,
okay,
it's
brilliant.
Just a good feeling. It feels very...
You're just being a good Samaritan?
Yeah, I don't know. It just feels very American. It just feels like a good thing to do, to sue the government. It's it brings me... Maybe it's a...
That's your Christmas gift.
Indeed. Maybe it's another vestigial libertarian instinct, but it's fun to... I've always been, through my many political evolutions, a big free speech guy. And as we've discussed on this podcast multiple times, a big anti-sanctions abuse guy. So it's just very cool to be able to participate in something like that. So.
Do you think one way to, you know, protest against sanctions would be to fire lots of rockets at one of the world's maritime pinch points?
You know, that would be an approach. And, you know, it's interesting. It's funny. Some of the works of the Exchange Foundation that is suing the U.S. government, they put together sort of weeks-long courses on conflict zones. And some of the most benefit I've gotten out of working with them is conferences that they've put together on Yemen. And that is, of course, what you were alluding to and what we'll be discussing today, is the fact that Yemen, after a decade of being one of the most ignored countries and conflicts in the world, shamefully ignored countries and conflicts in the world, is now at the center of a lot of people's thinking because of the way that they've decided to react to Israel's war crimes in Gaza, which is to more or less, less than more, but at least threaten all commerce going through the Red Sea.
This is something they've done before, isn't it? It seems like there's been small rockets fired out in like 2015 and stuff, but what's caused the escalation recently?
I mean, is it, you may have found something I'm not familiar with.
Okay.
What's the 2015 incident you're talking about?
Well, I was doing my research with a Task and Purposes video, so they may have been trying to massage things to make it look like it had less to do with the current escalation in Israel-Palestine.
Well, so my understanding, and I'll have to look into this 2015 thing, because that was that actually the Houthis, despite being in control of the majority of useful Yemen, the majority of Yemeni territory where people actually want to live, and the majority of Yemen's population since 2014, has up to this point, and this is why I'm so frustrated by what the Houthis are doing, up to this point, they'd been pretty remarkable for their restraint, despite the fact that Saudi Arabia, the United States, and the United Kingdom had been acting to starve the country, blockade their main port, Hodeidah, for a number of years. The Houthis were actually really, really restrained, which was a sensible, despite having the capability to, always having the capability to massively interfere with Red Sea shipping, they just hadn't much. I don't know about that 2015 incident you're referring to. What the Houthis had done that I very much approved of was established deterrence with Saudi Arabia and the UAE, absolutely a capability that they were given in part by the Iranians. But after about 5 or 6 years of merciless bombing of Yemen by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the Houthis developed the capability to bomb back. And certainly by 2019, when it had been established that the Houthis had the ability to seriously damage Saudi oil industry. This is 2019. The extent to which the Iranians were directly involved in that attack is not fully established, but the Houthis had some control over the capability to take out 50% of Saudi Arabia's petroleum industry for a day or two. That kind of capacity had really never been exerted in the Red Sea. Hasn't actually yet, but the Houthis had this capacity to disrupt the Red Sea in major ways, and I think very wisely, because they wanted to keep the emphasis on how nasty what Saudi Arabia was doing to Yemen was, they simply didn't. They really didn't. I mean, and perhaps in 2015, were they going after a blockading ship or something along those lines? I'm just not familiar with that incident, and I'm now very intrigued in it. Generally, until just about a month ago, November 19th, they had largely not interfered with Red Sea shipping. And they somewhat spectacularly, with a helicopter bound, with a team on a helicopter, hijacked a ship on November 19th that was somewhat tangentially related to Israel.
That's still under their control as we're recording?
Really?
Am I right in that, or
I don't have the information one way or the other, but that would not surprise me.
I think, yeah, they're still holding them hostage as far as I'm aware.
Huh. Fascinating. It's very little that has happened since has been quite that spectacular. I mean, this was very clearly a raid constructed for the internet, for the footage. You can see the footage of carefully filmed, staged even, by the Houthis to demonstrate their professionalism and their capacity. It seems like most of what's been happening since has been just taking pot shots at ships. Some of them Israel connected, some of them connected to, I think they might have fired on a U.S. naval ship. Very few of these missiles have connected in meaningful ways, which honestly, I don't think the Houthis, I think it probably would have been a more complicated and difficult problem for the Houthis had they managed to sink a bunch of ships at this
I
point.
Think
or had
who
they
have been on target, but what I find strange is they say these have GPS, are using GPS as a coordinates, but from what I understand, that is a GPS is US military technology, and it has something in it that goes, oh, this is a missile, and refuses to give it any information. So I don't know what's going on, you know, in that regard. But yeah, I feel like just essentially firing missiles in that direction is going to worry massive ships full of petroleum.
Indeed. There is the interesting detail that a lot, despite the fact that British Petroleum is one of the biggest companies to say they will not be using the Red Sea now, there's some indication that they're largely staying away from the oil tankers because they don't want to directly antagonize any of the Arab states who are very invested in those oil tankers, which is actually proving to be very disappointing for the Saudis and the really anybody in
United Arab Emirates.
Well, anybody in OPEC who was hoping that this would lead to a big spike in oil prices. It did yield a big movement, a spike in oil prices, but it was sort of on the order of 5 or 6%, and is already deflated quite largely in recent days. So the big story with the oil prices is how stubbornly low they are, and the fact that the Houthis don't want to directly antagonize any Arab petroleum-producing states means that the Red Sea and the Suez Canal will still be largely open to a lot of oil and gas transit, which means prices won't be as impacted as, you know, folks from Texas to Moscow might be hoping. So it is interesting the extent to which this is, it's incredibly dangerous, I think, is the main thing to point out. As with a lot of incredibly dangerous things that have been happening over the past couple months, well, over the past 2 years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we do keep lucking out. We do keep realizing that the system is more durable and more stable than
robust than we thought.
Than we thought, exactly. More robust than we thought. I mean, if you'll remember when Russia invaded Ukraine, it wasn't just the Peter Zeehans and the other crazies who were talking about widespread starvation in Europe in the winter of 2022-2023. That was a concern that I talked about on perhaps not quite as panicked as others did. You know, I talked about on my channel and various outlets, and that sort of came to nothing. And with Hamas's horrific attack on Israel and then Israel's apocalyptic retribution, apocalyptic and ongoing retribution, I became very concerned about the chances of a much wider regional war. Seems like Iran and Hezbollah aren't willing to risk it, though there are people in Israel who are still trying to push for that very hard. We continue to get lucky. And I think even with this kind of nuts action, incredibly nuts action by the Houthis, the de facto government of most of Yemen, we are seeing a very high chance that this too will come to nothing in terms of the hopes of petroleum exporters or those who are hoping for a larger chaos, larger war, larger fall of the American empire. But that doesn't mean it's not incredibly risky.
Does this show that the Houthis are more independent than we've been led to believe, since it would appear that Iran would like them not to do this?
I think that's one interpretation. That's an interpretation that I would like, but I think that's a little too,
optimistic.
Optimistic, yes. I think that the Houthis are judged. If Hezbollah were carrying this out, it would accurately be the opinion of the U.S. government and Israel that Iran had approved it, because Hezbollah is much more linked in. But it may sound like I'm agreeing with you, but I'm not quite, in that, like, the Houthis are generally recognized by people who know what's going on to be more independent of Iran. So it's not necessarily the case that Iran doesn't like what the Houthis are doing right now. They like that they have more plausible deniability. Does that make sense?
So yes.
They wouldn't, the Iran right now, because of its orientation, because of its just really not wanting to get into a major war right now, would be very angry if Hezbollah were doing this. But if the Houthis are doing it, not as much of a problem for them. So I think it overstates it to say that this is like an indication of Houthi independence. It's more of an indication of a perception of Houthi independence. Did that make any sense?
Yes. Has this a lot to do with, was it the tanker wars? The SS Stark, when it got
hit? Oh, man. We will get into that, but just in an effort to distinguish this piece of media a little bit from the YouTube live that I did on this just 2 days prior, I do want to talk about the one new thing that has occurred to me, and it's something that I never like to say, and should be quite surprising to my audience. Are you ready for this? This is a big thing for me to say. Well, I don't anticipate saying it much ever again, but in this instance, Saudi Arabia is a good actor.
Oh, my God.
I know. I feel terrible about it, Rory. But
I think you've been hacked.
It's undeniable. You should actually check to see if I've been kidnapped.
Okay.
I do have to concede that in this particular instance, Saudi Arabia is trying to do the right thing as far as, honestly, I mean, 100% for its own interests, but in this instance, with what the Houthis are doing right now, they're actually looking out for Yemenis more than the Houthis are, and certainly much, much more than the United Arab Emirates are.
Is this because they have so much to lose if this escalates?
Exactly. Exactly correct. And specifically, since 2019, since that Houthi attack that sort of fully established deterrence, the deterrence was fully established in 2022 when the Houthis were getting a certain level of success, and then that success was rolled back by heavy reinvestment by Saudi Arabia, a little bit, but mostly the UAE in the conflict, and the Houthis responded by bombing Saudi Arabia and the UAE very quickly in quick succession. And from that point in early 2022, the war that we'd been watching and that I'd been condemning since 2015 was largely over. But for Saudi Arabia, this goes even further back. This goes back to 2019. So since 2019, yes, in 2022, they did contribute in small ways to a renewed offensive or attempt to defend their proxy government in Yemen. But since 2019, since that big attack on the Abqaiq refinery, that we talked about just a few minutes earlier, Saudi Arabia has desperately been trying to end this war in Yemen. It is a horrific war that they deserve the vast majority of the responsibility for. It was launched and vastly escalated in 2015 by a Saudi invasion of Yemen. But really, like, they've known, this is actually, I suppose it's much like the Nixon administration in the United States, that knew as soon as it was elected in 1968 that its job was to somehow extract itself from Vietnam. MBS has known since 2019 that he has to somehow extract himself from Yemen. The United Arab Emirates is less interested in being extracted from Yemen. I ran a video, 3 or 4 years ago at this point, saying the UAE has won in Yemen. The United Arab Emirates is in a sort of large scale, was it Jim Mattis, Donald Trump's Secretary of Defense, famously called the UAE the little Spartans or something along those lines. It's actually kind of the little Athenians, at least in what they're attempting to build. They're attempting to build sort of a naval empire in a very 19th century sense, which kind of makes sense because they are a monarchy. And in the interstices of the absurd chaos that the United States has unleashed on the region, Middle East, North Africa, over the past 20 years, The UAE has been largely successful in doing that. And the UAE, unlike Saudi Arabia, that wanted to seriously change the government of the, you know, the internal, you know, the internal politics of Yemen by getting rid of the Houthis, the UAE just wanted to put militias in charge of ports. And the UAE successfully managed to put militias in charge of ports. Aden, Aden, specifically, the big, largely British-built port is pretty much controlled by the UAE through militias. They are in control of Socotra and I believe another island, though that is disputed and goes back and forth a bit. I think they are mostly in control of Azat al-Mukalla. They've succeeded. They've gotten what they wanted. And the big UAE concern over the past year or so has been negotiations between Saudi Arabia and the Houthis, because that can completely change the end game of this conflict. If Saudi Arabia and the UAE remain endlessly committed to fighting and trying to destroy the Houthis, Saudi Arabia just keeps getting humiliated, keeps losing more and more people and money and territory, while the UAE continues to control all these ports. UAE continues to get whatever it's won. It was actually a rather savvy thing that Saudi Arabia realized sort of a year or so back, or maybe 2 years or so back, and was just like, wait a second, we're losing all of this money and being humiliated everywhere by the United Arab Emirates just to preserve their victory here. And all the Saudis had to do was start talking to the Houthis to make that victory evaporate. And the UAE is taking a very different tack to these Houthi attacks on shipping. So the Saudis are saying, hey, 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 yeah, like we're going to, sure, like we're going to do what we have to do. We're going to do what's necessary to defend commerce. But let's talk about this. Let's not escalate. Let's not, please, for the love of God, let's not spend another decade trying to destroy the Houthis, because that's what we just did for a decade. And it's been an immense failure for us.
Because didn't they originally start off by firing missiles over Saudi Arabia to try to hit Israel?
Well, that was certainly one of their earliest moves in reaction to October 7th. And that was very easily dismissible, because the idea that you're going to successfully fire missiles. The Houthis have been doing, they've generated two firsts, apparently, in warfare. I think that the firing of a ballistic missile, and then Israel used some kind of countermeasures that apparently took place in space. So there's been tests of these sorts of weapons before. But apparently, I mean, if you were envisioning in the mid-20th century how the first actual space battle would go, you probably weren't envisioning two rival, vaguely genocidal, religious fundamentalist governments doing it.
And one of the poorest countries in the world.
Yes, one of them being one of the poorest countries in the world. But that's what we got. We got two vaguely genocidal, religious fundamentalist countries, the Houthis and Israel, are our first Buck Rogers space battlers. Our very first Star Trek space battle was between rival bands of religious fanatics, which is quite something.
And Saudi Arabia is weirdly saying, please, can we stop fighting?
Exactly. And Saudi Arabia is like, can we all just kick back and do business together? There's a lot, you know, things do change. Things do change. It's very strange to find myself applauding Saudi diplomatic moves, but that's where I am on this topic. So there was the first space battle that was launched by the Houthis and successfully parried by the Israeli government, as I don't think anybody expected anything different. I mean, just the paucity, and I think that's sort of what we're seeing in this Red Sea battle. Sure, the Houthis are saying, oh, we're going to stop all shipping and this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, they have enough resources that they've built their own or that the Iranians have provided to every 3 months or so blowing up some buildings in Saudi Arabia or the UAE for like worthwhile deterrence purposes. They 100% do not have the kind of resources you need to take out, you know, 60 or 70 ships every day. that they just don't have that. There was another first that I don't quite understand. As we all know, I'm not so good with the military technology, but apparently it was the first usage of a ballistic missile against a ship.
Yes.
So I think they sent a missile up to a certain height that was a strange height to send it up to and used it to blow up a ship, which was sort of a strange thing to do, but is another first in warfare that the Houthis are apparently engaging in. One of the nice things, and I think one of the reasons that at this point we're able to talk about this with some humor and some somewhat blasé and calm ways, and could be completely different by the time this recording is uploaded on Monday. We're recording this on Thursday the 21st, and I guess it'll be going up on, oh gosh, what is that, Monday? Is Monday Christmas or something like that?
Yes.
Yes, it'll be going up on Christmas, and it's entirely possible that by that point, this whole conflict will be a lot less humorous, because one of the Houthis, and I think the Houthis to some degree are relying on their lack of capacity and their assumption that things aren't necessarily going to get too bad. It's entirely possible that the Houthis will manage to hit a ship in a catastrophic way, and this will be a lot more serious by Monday. As I've said, we've been incredibly lucky over the past months and the past years in the ways that things have just not escalated. And it's entirely possible that by the time, you know, at any point, by the end of this recording, by the time this recording is up, that our luck will run out. And the what is different about the, like, I can't believe I'm about to use this word, about the size and diversity of the battle space of the Red Sea, versus the somewhat more limited, okay, this is happening in Ukraine, this is happening in Gaza, this is happening in the skies over Israel, which are extraordinarily well defended. It's entirely possible that we could see large-scale loss of life, large-scale loss of commercial goods that would put a lot of people a lot more on edge. And the U.S. government has already begun to put the infrastructure in place that is necessary for a much wider war across the Red Sea. And that is terrifying. And I think that this is at the point we should get back to what you brought up, which was Operation Earnest Will back in the 1980s. And it's irritating to me, as I mentioned in the YouTube live I did on this, is just like, this is something that that CENTCOM is doing, the United States Central Combatant Command. I've talked about these commands that are basically viceroys. They're basically the way that the United States divides up the U.S. empire. And this, much like Operation Earnest Will, looks on the surface and is in some ways a worthwhile use of CENTCOM military force. And that's I find those situations incredibly irritating, right? Because they make all of the 40 years of abuse look worthwhile. Look like, oh, well, you know, it's sure is a good thing that we've got these massive military bases in Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, the UAE, more deniable forces in smaller in Saudi Arabia, Jordan, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sure is great. We've got all these resources here. Of course, the reasons that the Houthis exist, the reasons that a region are destabilized enough for people to even think of attacking Red Sea shipping have a lot to do with the fact that the United States has been setting up its little imperial bases there for the past 40 years. But now, looking at this, it's like, well, gosh, it's a good thing they're there.
Yes, and we trusted these countries, and look what they've done.
Exactly, exactly. It's and that's really, really irritating. So Operation Earnest Will was sort of how CENTCOM was born. I'll recommend again a book by Andrew Bacevich, which I think is the U.S. U.S.'s War for the Greater Middle East. And that book was really helpful to me because it emphasized that it really wasn't the war against Saddam Hussein in the early 1990s that gave CENTCOM its start. It was actually a war to save Saddam Hussein in the 80s called Operation Earnest Will, which Andrew Bacevich calls the first Gulf War, the real first Gulf War. where the U.S. Navy basically came in and saved Saddam Hussein from the consequences of his insane invasion of Iran. We essentially sank the Iranian Navy.
So they sank one, and America was like, you're not allowed boats anymore.
Yes, essentially. Essentially. Well, the amazing thing is the only military actor that put a scrape on the U.S. Navy in that conflict was the Iraqis.
Yes, which is really strange.
it's incredibly strange, especially, I think I might actually make a clip of this, sort of do one of my half-assed produced videos on this, because it came up in the live stream. There's, among internet denizens, there's a lot of people who will talk about the USS Liberty and how during the Six-Day War, it was so outrageous that some Israeli forces mistakenly shot up a U.S. ship, and it's a real obsession among Israel haters, and then, you know, transitioning from Israel haters into just flat out anti-Semites. And it's kind of fascinating that 20 years later, 20 years more recently, there's the USS Stark incident that killed more U.S. sailors, and nobody ever really talks about. And the reaction of the United States government to the Iraqis killing a whole bunch of U.S. sailors was to save Iraq from Iran.
Well,
it's just
sadly,
a general...
friendly fire incidents are just a part of war, which is one reason why we should avoid them at all costs.
Wars, yes. We should avoid wars at all costs. And I think that's that's a bit of a digression, but like if you see someone who's really, 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 really concerned about the USS Liberty almost 60 years after this attack happened, I mean, of course, it's horrible. Any loss of life is horrible. Mistakes against non-belligerents are horrible. But, you know, if you're really making it your online personality 60 years after the case, it's either a sign of deep ignorance or deep, I think, fairly described as anti-Semitic malice.
But this is exactly why you like to have third parties to do your missile attacks, so your Navy stays above the water.
There you are. And yeah, absolutely, Iran has very plausible deniability. Deniability that I find plausible. I do. There is no Iranian mastermind here being like, yes, go do this, Houthis. There may be an Iranian mastermind being like, cool, this works for us if you want to do that. But the Houthis are taking these actions. I think most folks listening to the podcast have heard my general spiel on the Houthis. The Houthis are the government of Yemen. They have been. They won a civil war in 2015. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates invaded to keep them from controlling the whole country. They successfully did kick the Houthis out of southern Yemen, which is a vastly less populated region that looks bigger on a map, but is mostly desert.
Exactly.
It's mostly desert.
The greener, more fertile parts are the parts that they control.
Yeah, there is a complication. It was a very helpful commenter that pointed out that Taiz, which is a traditional northern Yemeni city that is heavily populated, has throughout this war been contested between southern forces and the Houthis. So it's not entirely accurate, and I should be more careful about that going forward to say that the Houthis control absolutely all of the traditional north. But when you consider the immense resources of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, the immense support of the U.S. government and, to some extent, the U.K. government as well, the internationally enforced siege of northern Yemen, what the Houthis have done here over the past decade is incredibly impressive. They are an indigenous resistance movement. They are as much a non-state actor as like the North Vietnamese government was during the Vietnam War. They are pretty impressive, and they humiliated two of the nominally richest countries on the planet, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. I will always be impressed by that, but I am horrified by what they're doing right now. Not because I think it's necessarily even a bad thing to be disrupting shipping. I think it's actually one of the bigger signs of Arab self-respect we've seen over the past 2 months. Nominally, all these Arab governments care so much about the Palestinians, while the Palestinians are being exterminated right now. And the Houthis seem to be the only people stepping up. That I don't have a moral objection to that, especially when you consider just how non-lethal it's been to this point. I'd have very different feelings if they actually managed to, like...
I don't think anyone's been killed as of yet.
Exactly. I'd feel very differently if they managed to, like, kidnap an Israeli crew and started torturing them to death. I'd have very different feelings about that. I think that's a real possibility. Well, I mean, not that there are many actual Israelis on these ships. Most of the folks on these ships are...
It's also, yeah, there's very little Israeli shipping that goes through that part of the world.
Yeah,
it's something like 5% of their imports, exports go that direction anyway.
There's an Israeli port on the Red Sea, but that's sort of like, I think that's at, is it Eilat or something? But I think that's sort of at the edge of desert, right? And it's sort of a part of Israel that's sort of populated to make a point that it's ours and not actually...
It's also kind of more inland than you'd expect.
Huh. Interesting. So it's not like to the first point of why I am angry at the Houthis for doing this is I think it's tremendously dangerous for Yemen, the Yemeni people, frankly, who've suffered an extraordinary amount. And second, as you just pointed out, it's unlikely to impact Israeli actions much. It's not likely to be effective.
It has very little effect. And the other thing is, if there's one thing America is very good at and likes to do is kill people and blow stuff up.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
So I'm sure there's lots of people maybe in the U.S. Marines and Navy that are a bit excited at the moment.
You know, not yet. But the second we have a good justification, we have a tanker that, I mean, I don't know. How many people crew these tankers? I think it actually, even for the big ones...
It can be very low, like 28. Yeah. It can be not a lot of people.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, it's not charismatic, blonde-haired, blue-eyed. You know, it was the classic, you know...
Oh, yeah, an American movie.
Or in American media. I mean, the classic. You know, one blonde woman goes missing in the Caribbean, and it's national news in the United States for 3 weeks. Which is pretty disgusting. Most of the folks working these ships are people from the global south, that it's going to be very hard to get U.S. or European publics excited about. But there, who knows? There are many, many possibilities for this to get really big and really gross. And then at that point, when the U.S. military has what they feel to be a good, solid justification, then, yeah, we could see some really horrific relaunching of the war. And the problem is, for the Houthis, for the UAE, really for most of the actors in this war, other than Saudi Arabia, the proxies of the UAE and Saudi Arabia, mostly proxies of the UAE at this point, the Saudi proxies have just sort of been killed by the UAE proxies or just pushed out. All of those folks have profited from this long war. It's the Yemeni public, north and south, that will suffer if the United States decides to join this war in a bigger way. If the United States decides to join this war that was looking largely over, that's the extraordinary thing. There was a ceasefire in early 2022 that has since lapsed, but it just sort of went from a de jure ceasefire to a de facto ceasefire. The ceasefire ended after, I think, 6 months, but nobody started shooting again because the Houthis had established deterrence. What the Houthis have unfortunately realized in the period since establishing that deterrence is that when the Saudis are clearly beaten and clearly trying to negotiate with them, their legitimacy starts to suffer.
Is it also because the country is so poor, it's basically a nice distraction when they have to do the boring thing of governing a country?
Yeah. We see this over and over again. It's more sexy and more motivating to be fighting off an outside invader.
Oh, yeah. You know, freedom fighting instead of worrying about tax.
Exactly. And the Houthis, the tremendously sad thing about Yemen is that the Houthis are actually kind of the best at this. The Houthis are absolutely in a time of greater peace, the Houthis are absolutely facing larger fragmentation, factions in the north that they used to be able to rely upon are like, hey, okay, you know, the crisis has passed. What do we get now? Why are you still here trying to tell us what to do? But in the south, it's actually much, much worse. I think we had periods in 2022 and 2023 where most of the fighting and dying in Yemen was fighting between UAE-sponsored and Saudi-sponsored factions in the south. This is why, again, it's absurd, just laughable that people talk about this rump state in the south as being the internationally recognized official Yemeni government and are still talking about the Houthis as some kind of non-state actor. So as bad as the Houthis are at maintaining a peacetime government, they're the best at it in Yemen, which is really dark.
Yeah, it's a sad thought.
But that doesn't mean they're having any fun at it or want to keep doing it. So they, if they can successfully get into a real war with the United States, it's great for the Houthis. They'll, you know, all of their factions are fraying, get right back behind them, and it is freaking nightmarish for the Yemeni people. As we've seen in Gaza, the true machinery of money is no object. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? Human rights concerns? We're the people who do the human rights concerns. Like that being all thrown out the window, like that, what's happening in Gaza is much, much worse and much more intense in a much shorter period of time than what the Saudis did to Yemen. The United States, and of course, it's not having much impact on Hamas. It is having a nightmarish impact on the Palestinian public. So if the U.S. truly got involved in Yemen in a very big way, wouldn't necessarily hurt the Houthis much, but it would introduce a new hell to the Yemeni people. And goddamn the Houthis.
Basically destroy whatever infrastructure is
exactly
there.
And goddamn the Houthis for introducing that risk to Yemen. You know, the external politics, I think there's probably a lot of Yemeni people, north and south, that support what the Houthis are doing here and have a new respect for what the Houthis are doing here. But that's...
Well, one thought is the idea that they're like sort of standing up for the Muslim world by doing this and trying to, you know, show their solidarity and support
Palestine. They are standing up for the Muslim world. They are being, you know, showing more Arab self-respect than anybody else. But they shouldn't, you know. Yemen doesn't deserve it, you know, like that, like the consequences here are not, it's a really sad resonance to something that even more objectionable figure than the Houthis, Ali Abdullah Saleh, something that he did. This was the strongman of Yemen from the 1970s until 2012. He actually bears most of the responsibility for the birth of the Houthis because of the brutality of his mismanaged war to exterminate the Houthis from 2004 to 2011 or so made the Houthis much, much stronger. And then when he was turfed out of power in, I think, 2012, finally, is a Arab Spring aftermath, he then allied with the Houthis and helped them take the whole country.
Like a true politician.
Yeah. What Saleh did... and then, of course, the Houthis killed him in 2017. I wish for the death of no person, but it's in some cases it does look a little more deserved than others. Ali Abdullah Saleh maybe in that rare category for me, like Ali Abdullah Saleh and like Rush Limbaugh, you know, just like people are just like, you know, maybe the world's better without him. What he did in 1990 is actually kind of similar to what the Houthis are doing here, which I would think would make most Yemenis' blood run cold. You know, I have this mental block, Rory, where I can never remember whether the war against Saddam Hussein was 1990 or 1991. But for whatever year it was, Yemen had the great misfortune of having a seat on the Security Council. At the United Nations, this year's Security Council has, of course, five or six permanent members. And then it has a rotating group of other members who do have votes and power. And Saleh, in a sort of misguided fit of old school Arab nationalism, decided that he would, I don't even know if he really voted against something that the U.S. wanted or just abstained on a vote condemning Saddam Hussein for his invasion of Kuwait. And in retaliation, the United States and Saudi Arabia just murdered Yemen's economy, just absolutely slaughtered it. I bet it felt good and was might even have been popular for Saleh to make that point, you know, do one for the Arab team or what have you. And that may feel great for the Houthis to be doing what they're doing, but I don't think Yemen has recovered from Saleh's decision back in 1991. The Saudis literally, at that point, the Saudi and Yemeni economy were really, really intertwined. And the Saudis essentially just fired a million Yemenis and sent them back to Yemen. It would just absolutely crushed, ended kind of a mini Yemeni golden age. Yeah, I think that the Houthis have, you know, in part thanks to the Houthis, Yemen is in a position of independence and the real possibility of peace for the first time in a decade. And now the Houthis could potentially be throwing it away.
But isn't the country this will damage the most after Yemen itself is Egypt? They're losing a lot of money from the Suez Canal because that's a big earner for them. So the fact that, is it 4 out of the 5 big shipping companies have said, oh, we'll just go around Africa. We've had enough of this.
Yep. It's a huge, huge, huge risk.
So just to give a little bit of context, to go from Rotterdam to Singapore through the Suez Canal would be 8,400 kilometers or nautical miles, sorry. And to go the long way around Africa is 11,700 nautical miles.
The shipping companies kind of love it because it means that they're shipping more and they make more money. But this is a real concern for Europe, which has not had the best economic couple of years or decade, really.
Also, another canal is having issue. The Panama Canal doesn't have enough water. So it's like a sort of weird troubling time for, well, I guess it's good for the shipping companies, but for world trade, it can have a knock-on effect.
If this had happened during like the post-COVID supply chain nightmares or directly after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we would be in serious trouble and we would probably be, it's been a recent, very happy story in recent months. It does seem like worldwide inflation was in fact transitory. It just wasn't transitory on a couple month scale. It was on a 2 or 3 year scale. It really does seem like inflation has been beaten. And this sort of shutting down of the Red Sea in combination with those Panama Canal issues you very savvily brought up. There's Panama Canal seems to be running out of water thanks to El Nino. The possibility of a return of inflation is a real concern, less so in the United States, but very much so in Europe, which is a really bad thing. But to Egypt, as you mentioned, the risks to Egypt are extreme. Egypt is a barely functioning country, incredibly dependent on subsidies from the United States and from Gulf monarchies.
And is now getting a large number of refugees.
Yes, definitely. Well, I mean, they're refusing to take refugees, but they're trickling out anyway. And as conditions in Gaza get worse, it's going to become, I think that there's just going to be more refugees, which is going to be tremendously damaging for Sisi, the dictator in charge there. But so it's a really financially tenuous place. And for any country that might be having difficulty servicing its debts, dealing with financial instability, sources of foreign exchange are vitally important. Just access to dollars primarily. And where does Egypt get most of its dollars from when they're not, you know, checks written to the Egyptian military? From the Suez Canal. As you mentioned, 4 out of the 5 largest shipping companies have stopped, have decided we're just not going to do this. Now, I mean, who's to say? Like, there's incredible potential for negative developments. There's also potential for positive developments, less because of anything that the Houthis are doing, though they'll certainly declare victory if this works, than what's happening to Joe Biden and the polls in the United States, there's a real chance there has been a shift in U.S. politics and U.S. messaging towards Israel in recent weeks. It's possible to imagine that we'll have some kind of ceasefire, lasting ceasefire within the next month or two. So potentially Egypt will be okay. They'll be able to grin and bear it, make it through this. But yes, if this became, so, you know, just as there's an infinite downside risk, there's also significant positive risk. There could be some kind of, I don't think so, but by the time this episode is up, there could be some kind of broader move towards a ceasefire in Israel. I doubt it.
That would be a nice Christmas gift.
That would be an amazing Christmas gift. The Pope would like that. He's certainly lobbying for it rather hard. Yeah. So Egypt is at tremendous risk. You know, Egypt is, keep saying this, but Egypt is a country of 110 million. Yeah. If that country implodes, hoo boy.
And from what I understand, it's acting like a sort of backup Libya. A lot of the countries surrounding it are moving there and it's having a somewhat stabilizing effect. So if it collapsed, then it's just going to be like a Libya 2.0. It's going to be horrific.
Oh, yeah. And Libya, so the U.S. and NATO's destruction of Libya in 2011 had a tremendously destabilizing effect on the Sahel. It's essentially led to a lost economic decade for Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Central African Republic, Chad. I mean, and Libya is a country of like 6 million people. Imagine that with a country of 110 million. And as you point out, as bad as things are in Egypt, as nasty a dictator as Sisi is, it is still a...
It functions
and it
is... You could go there on holiday. It would be relatively safe.
I've had friends who've done it
but
recently.
The other horrible thing is, it's one of the biggest, most populous cities in the world, 22 million for its metro area. Like, that would just be absolute anarchy if it was to, you know, something horrendous was to happen.
Exactly. And if you think the Sahel looks bad now, if you think it's been humiliating, the number of coups, the U.S. and France getting kicked out of a number of countries, if you think that's bad now...
And if you thought the refugee crisis was bad before...
I think you'd just see... If Egypt fell down, you would see full-on... Was it Children of Men? Is that really? It's like a 2006 film with Clive Owen. It talks about a sort of a dystopian future, and then I remember watching it in 2014 and being like, "Oh, this doesn't seem like the future anymore. It just sort of seems kind of like now." But if you want to like truly savage European reaction to refugees, just like unquestionably just shooting people down at the border, that's how you get there, is if Egypt collapses. And that is just one of many risks of the ongoing extermination program in Gaza.
But is your gut feeling that this should fizzle out? There won't be a U.S. Invasion of Yemen?
We were dancing around this earlier. I don't think the U.S. wants to invade Yemen.
Okay.
I think that they have seen... I mean, why would you want to... Gosh, Ruri, that'd be as stupid as getting into Vietnam after France spent a decade getting its ass kicked there. Dumber things have happened. Like, that's exactly what the U.S. did in the 1960s. I think that enough people are aware, and that the U.S., I talked about this a bit on the live stream. It's not that the United States is overcommitted to the point where, you know, we couldn't get involved in another war. We couldn't go fight Venezuela and Yemen on top of this. But in order to do that, we would have to finally really start getting serious about what we were doing. And we would have to actually seriously cut into the profits of some of these weapons companies. You know, say, you're actually going to have to build things we need at something like what they cost. There are all kinds of ways to do that within the U.S. legal system. The Defense Production Act, a variety of levers that could be pulled. And I don't think Washington, D.C. wants to do that. They're like, hey, you know, between the mass murder we're doing in Gaza, between the much more righteous defense of Ukraine and sort of the ramping up for Taiwan, we're making enough money, guys, you know? And if we actually were to get committed in Yemen, then we'd actually have to, some of those guys would stop making as much money. And that is something that the U.S. Congress will not tolerate. So, yeah, it's just a complicated, crappy war. If Ukraine were to go full stalemate, Gaza were to shut down, then, yeah. I mean, if this were something that were still persisting a month or, 6 months from now in a much calmer world, then, yeah, I think the United States would be interested in diving in, because we need to have an active war somewhere to keep the wheels spinning. But we've got all the active wars we need right now. So I do think, yeah, I think it's possible, especially if we get to a point with the U.S. public and the U.S. Congress telling Israel, all right, stop, then I think we could get through this unscathed. But damn, is it risky, and stupid risk, Rory, stupid risk.
So on that note, let's hope no one gets hurt and that 25 crewmen get freed. We'll wish you all the very best here at the More Freedom Foundation podcast.
Cool beans.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.